Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Another week. Another hilarious move by Apple today. I woke up to the news that Apple again has decided that they are going to figure out how the I got it, you take it kind of how they get their money for Dutch dating apps. Once again, this is a podcast about Dutch dating. That's what we do.
Is that like carbon dating, or is that a different?
Yep. Like, you see someone across a canal, you make a connection, you ride your bike
over
there.
The number of rings that they've got.
That's just you give them a tulip. Anyway,
so this is so weird. It's so weird. I mean, okay. We talked about this a bunch before, and like how Apple is resistant to do anything that basically it's not 100% being forced into doing. But what is it is in some ways its approach to this is like the most passive aggressive teenager in the world. It's like, fine, you want us to like, fine, we'll let other people do this, but we're gonna lower our commission. We're still gonna charge a commission because we believe we can do that.
Yeah,
but it's gonna be 27%.
And you can't
like,
make me
what?
You can't
27.
Make me.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah. I mean, technically, I guess they can, but they can't make you.
And what was funny is that Google was the first company to publicly disclose that this was going to be the strategy. But Google and Apple are both doing it, which is, if your power over us is only that we make this an option, you're not saying we can't charge our commission. So we are going to charge our commission and make this an option.
Doing and it painful.
Marco was tweeting about it today, and I was laughing because his reaction is very similar to mine, which is it was very much a you gotta laugh because it's so hilarious that they're doing it this way. And it's and I said, I think on Upgrade at some point, I said, here is how this is going to go. They are going to make this stuff, this freedom of choice thing, so unpalatable that no developers want to do it, and you're going to end up in a situation where the regulators are like, haha, freedom, and all the developers are like, no, we don't want
right.
that freedom at what price, like this is terrible. Yeah. Because
27%.
Apple just wants to poison it, and so the question is, what happens next? Like, do Apple is playing a game where they seem to be saying basically, like, you can't tell us not to take money off of our platform as a fee. That making that illegal is they're betting like not gonna happen, and so they're just gonna go down this path of doing it this way.
The approach to this reads to me very much like the approach of essentially corporate tax adherence, which is we have to minimize basically all the money. Like, this is our, you know, fiduciary responsibility to our shareholders is we have to pay as little tax as possible because we need to make as much profit as possible. And it's basically reads to me the exact same way, which is, all right, you're telling us we have to do this thing. How is the way, like, what can we do to essentially make it as profitable as we can while still remaining within the letter of the law? And in this case, that was, let's drop it to 27%. Because, you know, I looked this up this morning, you know, you look at Stripe or something, Stripe takes just under 3%.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like, well, you're going to pay that extra 3% in credit card processing. And so you're effectively still paying 30% of your profit.
Yeah.
And so at that point, it's like Apple's like, yeah, sure, you can go do that. It's exactly the same and it's more work for you.
And
so
then,
why would you do that?
And there's a hilarious dialogue that pops up that says, this app, only Apple is secure and private, but do you want to use this thing that's the responsibility of the app developer? It's this super scare message that they throw
right.
up as well, which is also not surprising because that's what Apple does, is they throw up the scare messages. We know that from Audio Hijack, right? Where even though they're using a completely Apple approved method of capturing audio, you have to restart and lower security and get a scary warning to do a thing that is totally approved by Apple. So they like to scare people. Ben Mayo from 9to5Mac pointed out that also if you're a subscriber to a dating app, you know, after a year, Apple's cut drops to 15%. It doesn't seem like that's going to happen if you go to an external payment.
No, I don't think so. I don't think they are inclined to help anybody out who's not using their platform. Right. Yeah, I don't know. It is, again, I think it's whoever is in charge of, you know, sort of crunching those numbers, whether it's Luca Maestri or you know, someone else on the executive team or the lawyers or whatever. You know, they just want to like skim right by and basically make this as little bit of a problem as possible. Now, as you point out, the interesting question is what happens next? Do the countries and regulators and governments all say, nah, that's not what we meant, and come back with some sort of, you know, actual legislative fix? Or is it, like, as you suggested, people just sort of like, well, they, you know, we told them to do it and they did it. We're not really going to look too closely at how they did it, but I guess technically they followed the rules that we set down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a dangerous game.
Sure.
Because what they're doing, yeah, they're daring. Well, and I think this is the issue, is it's regulators have limited latitude, I think. Like, I'm not sure a regulator can say you have to take less of a cut, right? Like, I think that that's what Apple's game plan here is. Regulators are going to talk about competition and alternative methods, but not this, not breaking open the seal of, we're going to go down into your business practices and limit the amount of money that you can charge your vendors for things and stuff like that. Like, that is beyond the purview of the regulators potentially, and something that has to go back to, that would have to be put into law. And right. I think their bet is that that's just a step too far, because it requires you to regulate the nuts and bolts of a business and how a business does business, how it operates. And the, you know, the risk here is that the EU or the US Congress in an anti-big tech bill is going to basically reach down into the core of Apple's business and say, you can't charge this anymore, which is, I mean, I can see their thought, which is, that doesn't seem likely, but boy, if it happens, it's going to be terrible for them. So it's a big risk.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of things working in Apple's favor here, right? I mean, not the least of which is the fact they make a ton of money, and that accrues to a certain extent to, you know, politicians who want to, like, have interests in the, you know, the state where Apple does a lot of business, or, you know, places where it's thinking about doing a lot of business, right? That's money and politics all the way down. And they're, you know, a shining example of the economy of America. So all of that is things that kind of burnish its image in a way that will potentially protect it. That said, there is still a lot of attention being, you know, spotlighted on big tech right now. And I think there are some bills kind of slowly making the rounds in Congress that would allow for things like sideloading. But the other thing that kind of helps out Apple here is technical knowledge within the legislative bodies is extremely low.
Right.
What they know about, even with all their various aides and stuff and the, you know, the resources they can bring to bear, it still feels oftentimes like the politicians who are in charge of legislating this don't really understand the subject matter. And it is literally the most technical subject matter you have in some ways. So I think that helps it in the sense that crafting an effective law that is both something that requires Apple to make a technical change, but also is hard to circumvent, I think is very challenging.
Yeah, I also, I think when you talk about technical matters, what they do understand in large part is business matters. And this is Apple saying, this is actually about business. Like, if you want to regulate us, you're not regulating our tech, you're regulating our business practices. And then it's going to be, you are setting a precedent that the government can go in. And I mean, I know there have been examples of this in the past, in the 20th century, this happens sometimes, but you're basically saying, we're going to pass a law that limits the profit you can make, or limits your profit margin on a product. And that is, I mean, it's kind of like they're playing a game of chicken a little bit, but still, it's a real thing where I think lobbyists and staff and the elected people themselves understand that a lot better than they understand something like encryption or even how app stores work.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true. And it's, can they sort of navigate both of those, you know, those two areas and turn it into something that actually makes sense? Because, you know, there are cases where the business in sort of the techno industry, especially something like the App Store, which is a, you know, it's not a store, it's not a physical store, right? It doesn't operate on the same ideas that your, like, Walmart and your Target do necessarily. Like, that's a different, slightly different beast, but it is still playing by certain rules. And so can they sort of thread that needle? I think it's possible, but I'm not hopeful, and B, it's going to take a while, if nothing else. This kind of legislation goes very slowly, and you know, maybe Apple will garner enough displeasure from developers and the community at large, or maybe there will be more suits brought. It's unclear. I mean, the Epic suit is now being appealed on both directions, so who knows how that'll play out at a higher level. Lots of questions still out there, but I agree with you that it's one of those things that when you run down the lists of Apple's biggest sort of vulnerabilities and risks, the App Store is still right at the top.
Yeah, and I think we all look at it and say, this is not...
It's not worth it. Why are you doing this?
A hill worth dying on, right? Like, why are you doing this?
But yeah. Well, everybody's got their hill to die on, Jason.
Uh-oh.
I was thinking also this news. Wow. This is a little bit on the technical side, but business side. Facebook this week, Meta, had a bit of a rough week where they announced for the first time that they had lost users, and their stock took a ginormous plunge. So much so that it impacted a lot of the rest of the market. But an interesting position. Facebook chalked a lot of that up to Apple's their privacy changes in the last 6 months to a year.
Yes.
And it's fascinating because, like, you know, if that's enough to dent your business, then maybe your business was not on super solid footing to begin with. But also just sort of the nature of there, you can tell this whole idea of why Facebook decided they needed to sort of rebrand and point themselves towards that virtual reality future, because it seems like, you know, social networking is not a steady thing to build necessarily your company on, because it's by nature kind of transient and faddish in terms of
right.
who your market is. And they are, the fact that they are losing users does not shock me. I think it's going to be a long time before they lose so many that it really hurts them. But perception's a big part of that.
They'll lose relevance before they, you know, right?
Exactly.
They'll be irrelevant way before they... down on users. Everybody will be like,
"Who
is
there?"
I still have a Facebook account, but right, like that already is happening, but it will continue to happen. And yeah, I saw somebody make the comment yesterday that you need to start thinking of social media companies as temporary,
right?
That they all will pass, and TikTok is hot right now, and it will become passé, and there will be another thing behind it. And it's not like there isn't money to be made on them, but they all kind of pass by. And Facebook's ad business, I've enjoyed reading some of the coverage of it, because they all sort of like point at Apple, and then Apple basically says, like, we respect the privacy of our users, and we give our users the option to turn this on, and 75% of them turn it on because they don't want to be tracked. And that is kind of a hard argument to fight, even though, yes, it is true. And I think Ben Thompson has really done a good job of writing about this. What Apple's really doing is saying, you know, what you want to be is a first party advertising platform. You need to control it all yourself, and Apple gets to do that for its platform, right? Like, Apple can do App Store ads and make a lot of money, because Apple, even though it's Apple, knows exactly what apps you've got, and it can show you ads profiled and all that, but it's not creepy in the same way, because you're seeing Apple ads on Apple's platform for Apple's data. It's first party data, whereas Facebook doesn't have a phone app store platform and therefore has to aggregate it, and so Apple is sort of taking its ball back here. But at the same time, it's very hard to argue. So it's not necessarily altruistic in what it's doing, but it's very hard to argue against what they're doing, because they are also allowing users to choose this, and it's undercutting Facebook's business. And Facebook just has to do something else. They have to figure it out.
Yeah, that's why they're, I mean, hence the big play on virtual reality. Right. And I don't know if that will work out for them, at least to the, it's tough right now to imagine it becoming the kind of success that Facebook was in its heyday, in terms of like something that many people use,
right.
But it's not out of the question.
Well, and then on the Android side, right, Google is an ad company to begin with. So Google's got its new like ways of doing things. It unveiled a new thing to replace its old thing. It's like, instead of flocks, you've got like segments
topics.
Or topics or whatever it is. But it, in the end, it's the same thing, which is, it is a way for Google to make money on its platforms with advertising, because that's what Google is. And this is the truth of it, right? Is, if you boil this stuff down to what are these companies, you know, Apple is a hardware and services company, right?
Sure.
Facebook is an advertising company. Google is an advertising company. That is, I mean, Microsoft is, I don't know what, like a cloud platform company.
Yeah.
And it's not like Apple doesn't do advertising and Microsoft and all that, but like, but Facebook and Google are ad companies. Like, that's why Facebook makes money is ads. And that's just don't forget it, right? Like, that is their business. That's why they're there. And I think Apple looked at them and saying, why are they build? It's, I would say it's the same attitude that leads Apple to say, we want our cut to developers, is the attitude that it looks at Facebook and says, why did they build a big business on our platform? And we don't like that, so we're going to shut them down. And you know, in that case, it's, I think, an argument that seems a little less self-serving, but is still self-serving than some of these other arguments that Apple, sometimes Apple makes the argument and it's like it's completely self-serving. And other times you're like, well, the net result is good, but also it totally controls Apple. And I think that's in its DNA. I think that Steve Jobs, and I know I've said this a bunch, but like, Steve Jobs firmly believed, his attitude really was that the world was full of people trying to make bank on Apple's greatness, and that Apple almost died. And so now the lesson learned there is Apple is always going to take a cut of anyone who's trying to use Apple's products to make money.
Right. Sure.
Bottom line. And I think that's
stay alive.
And I think that's why they are so focused on hanging on to every dollar from the App Store that they can, is because it's just ingrained in their culture that even though there are probably people being like, we're playing a dangerous game here, because that's the risk here, right? It's not, the risk is that we all feel bad because we wish our friends, the app developers, made more money. The risk is that their business is going to get broken by laws and regulations that really mess it up when they could have negotiated maybe and landed somewhere else. Now, maybe not. Our counter argument is that this is the right approach, and that seems to have won. But I think it gets extra weight just on the idea that Apple doesn't want anybody establishing a business on Apple's platforms where Apple doesn't benefit. Direct monetarily,
sure.
Right? Because Apple benefits a lot. I know you've written about this a bunch. Apple benefits from apps being on their platforms, right? Like, the iPhone with no apps is no good. But Apple is so focused on the money when it comes to that. Like, Apple needs to benefit financially directly from apps making money on the App Store. Them,
right.
You know, burnishing the platform is not good enough
it's
for
not
Apple.
Enough. Right. It's not enough. And yeah, I mean, is that short-sighted? I think that's the real question, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, we'd all like to see a kinder, gentler is not quite the right word, a softer, gentler Apple that's just sort of like, oh, developers, guys really do great things for us.
I'm going through just yesterday, I went through the developer relations portion of the Apple report card, which is coming out Monday, and it's not good. It went up. When Phil Schiller basically took over and fixed a bunch of App Store things, because the issues then were like weird rejections and lots of delays and stuff. And the perception is that Schiller took that over and kind of whipped it into shape. But since that little perk up back in like 2016, 2017, it has slid down every year, and it's down further this year. And all the comments are really like that Apple, you know, Apple doesn't show a lot of respect for developers, that several people said it's a dysfunctional relationship, that, you know, Apple doesn't really value developers, and developers don't like Apple and Apple's rules, but they make money, so they stay, that there's not a lot of love there on either side, that people are no longer impressed with Apple's insistence that they love their developers, which they card out, you know, at June every year, because all of their other actions suggest that they don't, and that they just want to, you know, and it's not just like they want to take their money. They want to take their money, and also they're taking their money theoretically because they provide this platform, but the documentation is poor.
Right.
And there are lots of bugs, and they're not responsive, and like it's this whole big pile of things. But I definitely, and if you look at the people who are software developers and the responses they gave, like, you know, they are unhappy with Apple. They think that Apple is not just greedy and taking their money, but you know, it's that thing. It's like, well, this is expensive, but if I get value from it, then it's fine. And I think that that is the undercurrent there from a lot of developers is this is expensive and I get no value. You're just taxing me. Like, right. you're just charging me the most you can and not giving me anything in return, which was the original deal with the App Store, was like, look what we give you. We give you bandwidth. We give you financial transactions. We built this whole platform. And if Apple's argument is going to be the reason they charge 27% on Dutch dating apps is because they are maintaining this entire app platform for developers. Developers point to all of the things that Apple is not doing to help them be good developers and say, what?
Right, because Apple's argument there is essentially like, oh, well, you want to use other payment processing? Well, that's like, you know, that's 3%, is that we calculated of the 30%, 3 of those percents is what we charge for payment processing.
Right. But the so other 27...
carve that out. The other 27 is stuff we're still providing you, right? Because you're still using our platform.
Like APIs,
that is what Apple is definitely saying there.
Xcode.
Whether that's true is an entirely different story.
Yeah.
But I do think it's interesting. Apple has really spent a lot of time, and I would argue... I'm just thinking about this a little bit. It's like it's relationship with the two different parties, right? You've got, on the one hand, it's relationship with developers, and on the other hand, a relationship with its, you know, consumers, users, et cetera. And there's certainly a lot of overlap there, right? Every developer is a consumer as well. But if you chalk them up to like the percentage of overall consumers who are also developers, it's fairly small, right? Most of the people who buy Apple products are not also making stuff for Apple products.
Right.
And I think about this a little bit and go back, you know, it's like, well, on the one hand, maybe Apple like really struggled when the App Store came out and like trying to redirect its, like, how do we treat developers when we kind of have a model for treating consumers? So I'm like, yeah, but they've had a platform people have built in software for, you know, 45 years. It feels like they should be better at that. I wonder if some of it comes out of the sort of reinvention of Apple in the 2000s that are really highlighted by like the iPod, right? Because that was a relationship that was purely consumer, right? Nobody was writing software for the iPod, really. That was just Apple. They made a device. It was a widget. They sold it to consumers. They didn't have to deal with developers. All they had to do was say, like, here's a box we made. Go buy some music and put it on this box. And I think Apple... in some ways longs for the purity of that relationship, or what it sees as the purity of that relationship. But we just make a widget, we sell it, we take in the money. But once the App Store took off, and of course, let's not forget the App Store not originally shipped with, like, it took a year for it to show up.
Yeah.
Because Steve Jobs was pretty convinced that web apps was going to be the way of the future.
Well, good enough, and allowed them to completely lock down the platform, right? Which is what they really wanted to do. And it would not have been as successful if they had kept with that. But they realized that.
Yeah. And so I think that they have struggled ever since then with this like idea of feeling, you know, like, oh, well, our phones should, you know, our widgets should be good enough for anyone. But I guess the apps, I guess if you want to get stuff from like other developers, like, that's fine. But I feel like they resent it in some ways. And it comes through in the way that they treat developers, is like, we don't like the idea that our perfectly constructed device is not enough for our users. So like, as much as they tout how awesome it is that there are all these apps and games and everything, you look at stuff like Apple Arcade, and that's a good example again of, even though those are third party, you know, games that people have made, Apple has even more control over something like that and wants to sort of put out this idea of like, here are the best stuff. Here's the stuff you should be playing. And yeah, we're going to take some money as part of that as well, because like, it's our idea. We're assembling this catalog of great games for you to play. And I'm sure they would like to avoid a lot of the headaches that come with it. I've saw that the developer Costa Eleftheriou, who is the one who finds a lot of the scams, is currently engaged in some legal wrangling with Apple over his own app. And as several people in the report card mentioned, to give that little peek again, there's a lot of people who are frustrated with the fact that, like you said, not only do we not provide documentation, but the App Store itself is really not doing a great job right now of curating all the crap that's on there.
Lots of scams get through, while lots of legitimate apps get held up in review.
And that's, you know, only fueling the discontent. And I can understand why. I mean, that's maddening. And so in some ways, I feel like Apple does sometimes treat it as a Pandora's box that it opened, and it's got great stuff in it for Apple. But at the same time, it's also it's also opening up to a lot of regrets. Yeah.
Regrets. Yeah. Yeah, but it has made them a huge amount of money and made them not only directly but indirectly, right? Because the truth is, the success of the iPhone is that's what burns me the most about this whole thing. Is like, I don't deny that Apple should benefit from the success of its platforms, but I would argue that the App Store is, and all the apps in it from third party developers are what makes the iPhone valuable, or at least help make the iPhone valuable. And Apple seems to be of the opinion that Apple deserves 100% of the money from selling iPhones and 30% of the money from selling apps. And I did the math at one point, and I didn't end up doing the post, but I did the math at one point where I was going to do, what if Apple paid developers 30% of iPhone revenue? Just to be fair, right?
Yeah, right. Sure.
But they don't. They want 100% of that and 30% of the App Store, or 15, or, you know, and in that report card, the other thing that comes up is, like, it's great that they did the small business program, but again, it's one of these cases where they could have made it that off your first million, we take 15%. Instead, they made it, you've got to apply, and if you go over, you're out for a year, and there's all of this stuff in there with paperwork and all that, and it seems to me that all of that is in there out of spite, because they don't want to give... they don't want to give Epic Games even a break of $1 million, right? Like, right, on the first million. They don't want to give any of these big gaming companies a break on the first million. They want it all. And I thought, like, really? Like, you're going to make all the small developers fill out the forms and sweat whether they're over $1 million or not?
And it's just that a very little bit here could go a long way, right? That's the thing that's kind of the killer, is like, it just... not doing that would have engendered a bunch more, like, you know, appreciation. Like, they just aren't willing to leave anything on the table. And that is now a fault. It used to be a virtue because they were a hard scrabble company and they were trying to stay alive. And that has now become a liability because it is greed. If you can't leave anything on the table, then you're being greedy. And sooner or later, it's going to bite you.
Yeah. Well, we'll see where it goes. This is one of those stories of our time. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Is there anything else before we go? I want to at least mention, you and I both wrote about Apple's headset at Macworld this week.
Mm.
You about the very funny like question about the metaverse in the analyst call last week, where Tim Cook was like, "Nope, not gonna use that word." But still bullish on AR and VR. And then I wrote a piece. I went back and found when he started talking about AR and VR, and it was the year they unveiled AR Kit. So that's I think 2017.
It's a while ago.
5 years ago, coming up now. And that was the moment where everybody's like, oh yeah, okay, this is where they're going. And I tried to detail in mind some of the other ones. The one that I keep coming back to, and when I played VR poker with friends on the Oculus Quest last weekend, I had that moment again where I'm reminded, oh, Memoji is just a stealth way for Apple to create its avatar, VR avatars, right? Like, Memoji is VR avatars. That's what it is.
I wrote this piece a few months back, which was talking about all the technologies that we've seen them roll out that you're kind of like, oh, this is like table setting for VR stuff. And Memoji was one of them. SharePlay and Spatial Audio, I think, were a couple others where it's like, yeah, I can kind of see how you would use those as things in a VR experience. So I don't know. I saw you guys playing poker and thought that seems cool. That's enough to kind of convince me. I was like, oh, maybe I should get a VR. Yeah,
boy, that software is super janky. But
oh yeah, VR software in general.
And I had the app crashed on me a bunch of times, and I had to restart the thing and all that. But it was fun. I mean, it really was. Me and Steve and Chip and Steven, and we were around a table playing poker and just and shooting the breeze too. And actually, one clever thing about, for people who have not used Meta's, you know, Oculus's platforms, you can have a party, which is basically a voice chat. And then it can be tied to a location in an app. So the way it was set up is our friend Steve created a party and invited us to it. And then all of a sudden, even out in the main menu of the Oculus Quest, I could hear all three of them, and they could hear me. And then Steve created a table in PokerStars VR, and we could do, there's like an interface in the party to travel to where Steve is, where the party is. And so you can do that with different apps. So they've built this kind of like overarching kind of social system that lets you link into an app, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. And keeping in mind, these are basically like smartphone level apps because it's smartphone level hardware in this thing. It's an Android phone essentially strapped to your head. But the truth is, then you're sitting there talking to people and they've got their little avatars and you can move your arms and you can throw in the chips and they have little things. You can like get a rubber ducky and throw it out on the table and stuff. It's just,
that's not a valid bet.
And it was, you know, it was fun, but it was mostly fun for the hangout. And then the poker was also there.
One of the things I always liked about gaming was, you know, it was an excuse to get together with people, and, you know, to hang out and catch up.
Let me tell you, if this doesn't already exist, a Roll20, which is what we use for D&D, something like that is going to be big in VR because of the same reason, is imagine rolling dice and looking at a map on a table. And maybe having some, because it's VR, some special effects where, you know, the monster appears and you can see him and everybody's got their little avatar of their character and it's got stats on it. And that you
if
can,
you're not...
It's like a Star Wars hologram kind of thing. Like, that would be
if you're
awesome.
If you're Roll20 and you're not already thinking about that, you should probably get on that because it's going to be a thing.
Yeah, because you could actually like have the terrain and have the monsters appear and have your guy that you move around and all that. Like, and you're also just hanging out with your friends and that's also fun. So the only issue I have is that we ended up, this is my first VR lesson that I really learned, very important for the future. Everybody keep this in mind. We ended up referring to looking at the ceiling. And that was because I had to tilt my head way back in order to drink beer under the goggles. So I'm drinking beer out of a glass and tilting my head back. And they're like, Jason, you're looking at the ceiling. And I said, yeah, well, that's because I'm drinking beer. And then looking at the ceiling, I'm like, excuse me, I need to look at the ceiling for a minute. Glug, 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 back down.
In the future, we'll all be drinking our beer with straws,
Jason. Well, that's what I said when somebody's like, oh, I'm going to go get another beer. And I'm like, get a straw.
Oh, wait, Jason, hold on. I've got a business idea. Remember those beer helmets? It's a beer helmet VR.
VR. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's an attachment that all of them will sell, that you put the beer up in the helmet. Yeah, that's $1 million idea, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, that ends this week's podcast about Dutch dating.
Sure. Is that Dutch? I'm sorry if it's not. I don't know.
I mean it is. Dutch and German are similar. I've been to the Netherlands a couple of times. So
I was gonna say, I've spent an hour in the Amsterdam airport, I think. So that's my extent.
It's a nice airport, but I've been to Amsterdam recently, and it's great. I love Amsterdam. And I took the Snell train to Harlem, which was also beautiful, which is just right outside of Amsterdam. Lots of flowers. Lots of very pretty. Anyway, hi to all of our Dutch people out there. I hope you're finding happiness. And if not, there's an app for that. Until next week. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.